This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier this year, it looked as if an agreement had been reached that might just bring peace to Darfur, the western province of Sudan that's suffered from both rebellion and from a government counterattack that many characterize as genocide. Numbers are impossible to confirm, but as many as 450,000 may have been killed, with 2 million more made homeless. 7,000 troops under the auspices of the African Union arrived to help stabilize the situation in Darfur and to assist the delivery of humanitarian aid. Now it looks as if it may all come unraveled. The Sudanese government sent thousands of regular soldiers to reinforce its Janjaweed militias in Darfur and resumed combat against two rebel groups who rejected the peace agreement. Aid workers found themselves caught up in the fighting. 12 have been killed in recent months. Then, last week, the United Nations Security Council approved a peacekeeping force more than 22,000 strong to replace AU forces if the Sudanese government agreed. It has not. Instead, President Omar Hassan al-Bashir ordered AU troops out by the end of this month. If they leave, most aid workers would likely follow. Later in the program, a biography of the quintessential independent reporter, I.F. Stone. But first, the new crisis in Darfur. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa and by the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, and we want to hear from you. If you have direct experience in Darfur, or if you have questions about what's happening and what the United States and the UN ought to do about it, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. We begin with Bruno Jockum, the Director of Operations for Doctors Without Borders, who recently returned from Darfur. He's with us on the phone from Geneva in Switzerland. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Yeah, hello.
Hello, yes. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, can you tell us what's happening on the ground right now in Darfur?
Well, the situation on the ground in Darfur is that our medical teams are basically active in the camps of displaced people,
mm-hmm.
Which are kind of islands of assistance in an area where access to remote areas is extremely difficult. Basically, most of our teams today are not able to travel by road, and therefore we face enormous limits in the assistance we're able to provide to current victims of warfare.
How bad is the security situation for aid workers?
I would say that in these islands of assistance, which are the main towns of Darfur, we are able to provide care for the displaced. The problem is when we want to move out, where we face number of incidents, and we can say that since the month of July, there's been a tremendous increase leading to deaths of some NGO workers. And in many cases, we've had to interrupt, for example, mobile clinics, which were providing medical care. And we have enormous difficulties referring patients to surgical hospitals, for example.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, who's been responsible for those casualties amongst the aid workers?
Well, I think it's very much multifactorial. There's not one answer to this. I think what we're facing in Darfur is a very deteriorated situation where there's a fragmentation of many armed groups. I would say all parties are responsible for these incidents, and this goes up to also Chadian rebels, which are today based in the Darfur territory, but also ordinary banditry. So there's not one single answer.
Mm-hmm. And the people who are suffering, of course, are those people who are at this point beyond your reach.
Yes, I would say that the people who are today suffering most directly are the people who are in the areas where fighting is still going on, where villages are still being destroyed and displacements still taking place. On the other hand, there remains about 2 million people who have been in camps for about 2 years. And these people are totally dependent on humanitarian assistance. the situation for them is not critical, but they are totally dependent, and they are more or less imprisoned in these camps with very little space to move out and frequently facing security incidents.
If African Union forces are indeed have to leave the country, was it your opinion that most of the NGO groups, including Doctors Without Borders, would they leave as well?
As MSF, Doctors Without Borders, we don't use the African Union for escorts or anything like this, because we are independent in our activity, so we would certainly not be leaving because of this. And I think it's important to recall that the main mandate of AU forces is much more the protection of their observers than the protection of the civilian populations, which is also the main limit of their action.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think that would make much difference to those to that civilian population if African Union troops had to leave?
Well, what we can say is that today this protection is not effective and or insufficient, and certainly the main function of the AU and its main mandate is to protect its own force of observers.
Bruno Jockum, thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bruno Jockum joined us by phone from Geneva in Switzerland, where he's director of operations for Doctors Without Borders, MSF, Médecins Frontières. He just returned from Darfur. The United Nations Security Council approved a peacekeeping force for Darfur, but thus far, Sudan's government has refused to accept it. To explain what the United Nations is doing about this, we go now to New York, where Mark Malik Brown joins us by phone. He's the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations. Good to speak with you again, sir.
Well, thank you.
Can you tell us how the UN is responding to the news from Khartoum and from Darfur, for that matter?
Well, with great concern, the Secretary General, who is himself in the Middle East, called me yesterday to ask me to make sure that the Security Council, he hoped they would meet as quickly as possible to take stock of this, because, you know, this is quite a setback in that we've always made it clear that the sheer nature of the mission, a deployment in a place the size of France, in the middle of nowhere, in the sense that it's in the middle of Africa and there is no obvious logistics support nearby, mm-hmm. means that this must be done with the consent of Sudan. And in fact, more broadly, peacekeeping always needs to be done with the consent of all sides to the conflict. Otherwise, it's not keeping the peace. It's trying to enforce one. And so, you know, this we've got to persuade Sudan to change its mind is the bottom line on this.
And how is that going to be done, do you think?
Well, I think to start with, a lot of diplomatic pressure, not just important though it is from the U.S. and Western countries, that's vital, but it needs to be supplemented by pressure from China, by pressure from Sudan's Islamic and African neighbors. Sudan just has to have a full understanding of the broad costs to its political and diplomatic standing if it presses on with this. But I think the other thing that needs to be done is we need to talk to the Sudanese, sit down with them again, as we have, as the U.S. has, and others, to try and find a way forward which tries to address their concerns without compromising on the basic principle here, which is these desperate people need international protection now, and we've got to find a way to deploy.
When you speak of Sudan's African neighbors, who are you speaking of?
Well, I mean, Nigeria, South Africa, Tanzania, a number of countries have engaged quite often on this, and we need to get them to do so in a more concerted way, and perhaps with the North African neighbors as well, notably Egypt, with Islamic neighbors such as Saudi Arabia. We've got to break out of the way in which this is at the moment, to some extent, characterized as a kind of Western versus Sudan issue. It's got to be seen as an international community versus Sudan issue if we're to be successful.
Does that mean incorporating the Arab League as well?
It does, and the Organization of Islamic States as well, Islamic Conference. I mean, we've got to get as broad a coalition of diplomatic support as possible for this intervention.
We're speaking with Mark Malik Brown, Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Michael. Michael's calling us from Towson in Maryland.
Hi. My question is for Mr. Brown.
Yes, go ahead.
I've been taking a couple courses over at Towson University, and what we've noticed a lot through some of the documentation that we've been studying is that the UN has been changing its policy from simply listening to states based off of their national sovereignty, and now there's a change into believing that intervention forces should go in if it's an issue of personal security. And so my question is, why is it that the UN would be taking such a step back by not going forward and trying to take care of individuals that really do need help?
Mm-hmm.
I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks for the call, Michael.
Well, Michael, I think it's a very good question because you're right. We adopted this doctrine of the responsibility to protect, which is when there is mass human rights abuse in a country which the government is seen as either being in some part a cause of or at least is not stopping, then the international community has an obligation to intervene. And that new doctrine was proudly adopted less than a year ago, and this is the first big test case of it. And so far, the results are not what one would wish for, because the fact is, the international community, when it chooses to intervene through the UN, that means it's got to put up soldiers, troops, it's got to kind of exert the political will to do it. And it's, you know, that political will has been uneven. Out of Washington, there's been pretty consistent condemnation of Darfur, but not out of many other capitals. And what there is no evidence of out of any capital is a willingness to put up the troops necessary to do the job, because the UN doesn't have a standing army of its own. The UN is the troops it borrows from its member states. And, you know, at the moment, nobody's going to put their troops up unless there's an armed agreement with Sudan that they're not going to come under attack from the Sudanese government. So the fine words of this very important are proving very hard to implement.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We have to take a short break. We'll come back with Mark Malik Brown, the Deputy United Nations Secretary General, and more of your calls. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the ongoing violence and the deepening humanitarian crisis in Darfur and what the UN and the U.S. are trying to do to help. In a few minutes, Jendai Fraser, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, will join us. Right now, our guest is Mark Malik Brown, the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations. And, of course, you're welcome to join us as well. If you have direct experience in Darfur, if you have questions about what's happening there and why, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is talk@npr.org. And Mark Malik Brown, there was a story in today's Washington Post which quoted observers and members of the African Union force in Darfur and analysts as saying it was their belief that what's happening is that the Sudanese government is trying to get on with its offensive, crush the rebellion, and get out before UN forces have time to deploy. Is that your perception?
Well, we hope it's not true, but there has been a massive movement of soldiers and armament into the region, which, you know, certainly gives every indication that some kind of military operation may be close. And, you know, that's why we're so anxious that the Security Council, you know, sits down to discuss this as quickly as possible and sees what we can do to counter it. Now, Jendai Fraser, who's your next guest on this program, has just recently been in Khartoum in a very important diplomatic effort to try and head this off and get this thing back on track mm-hmm. towards a UN deployment. And I think, you know, it's not too late for diplomacy yet. And that's the goal has got to be to persuade the Sudanese that we, the UN, should be allowed initially to buttress and strengthen the African Union force, and then subsequently to replace it, although undoubtedly keeping many elements of it and rehatting them as part of a larger UN force, and that this is the way to achieve Sudan's objectives of getting political peace in Darfur, and that an effort to do this by a unilateral military action would both be a breach of existing Security Council resolutions, a breach of the political agreement it negotiated for Darfur in Abuja, and a complete breach of Sudan. Sudan's relations with much of the rest of the international community, and they've got to come to understand the costs of what they may indeed be contemplating doing.
And where are those costs being spelled out to them?
Well, in the Security Council, but they've not necessarily been willing to listen. In many conversations and correspondence between Kofi Annan, our Secretary General, and President al-Bashir of Sudan, and in many other contacts at different levels by both the UN and the diplomats of our member states with their Sudanese counterparts. But, you know, at the moment, frankly, a lot of what we're saying is falling on deaf ears.
Let's get another call, this one from Missy in Fergus Falls, Minnesota.
Hi. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Abishai, Chad, in the late 80s and early 90s. And Abishai is on the border with Sudan. And I know that France has an air base there. And I'm wondering why France isn't asked to help patrol or monitor that border of Darfur with their Mirage jets.
Well, look, France is, as you rightly say, I mean, there is an air base there. They are still there. But they're very anxious, as much for their situation in Chad as any prospective situation in Sudan, that they not use that to sort of intervene on their own in the affairs of Sudan. They want to do any support they do through a UN deployment, so nobody can say this is France messing around in the internal affairs of an African country. I mean, everybody needs that blue UN flag to protect them against the charge that they're somehow playing politics in Africa. And so getting this overall UN deployment, of which French support can be part, in place is critical.
Missy, what was that border area like when you were there?
Well, when I was there, we actually, Chad, there was a coup d'etat in 1990. And actually, we were moved out of Abishai, and I'm not sure that they still post Peace Corps volunteers there anymore.
Okay, Missy, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Can you, Mark Malik Brown, this is a remote area. Sudan, of course, the largest country in terms of size in Africa, south of Egypt. Its eastern border is on the Red Sea. This is in the western part of the country. If you could speak just for a moment about the logistical difficulties of operating in this part of Africa.
Well, you know, it is right, you know, it's landlocked. It's a long way from ports or anything like that. You have to fly everything in, and the place itself is so large that our whole vision of peacekeeping there is that we would have a highly mobile force that could be moved around by fixed-wing planes and helicopters, because if we try to just carpet the ground with enough troops to keep the peace everywhere, it would swallow up tens of thousands of troops. So hence the idea of a very mobile group, force that could be moved quickly to where there was trouble. But this very long supply line, either through Sudan, which would be the likely route, or otherwise through Chad on its border, you know, it really means that no military planners want to take this on without a fairly high assurance that the basic mission of the force is not going to be challenged, that the military confrontations are going to be limited to individual incidents with those resisting arrest or whatever. Because, you know, the supply line is just so easy to cut if you're there without a basic political agreement with the parties.
This is another caller, Meshach. Meshach is calling us from South Bend, Indiana.
Hi.
Hi.
I am from Kenya, and one of the concerns I have about Sudan is the fact that the South, which was just incorporated into the government, has not had a chance to make major policy changes in the Sudanese government. And I know that would really affect the Sudanese government mindset into Darfur.
What Meshach is talking about was the long-running rebellion in southern Sudan, which was resolved a few years ago. The southern Sudanese were incorporated into the Sudanese government, but Meshach says their point of view was people who've been long in rebellion has yet to be reflected. Mark Malik Brown, can the southern Sudanese, the followers of the late John Garang, can they be brought into this?
Well, obviously, there are now southern Sudanese, including the foreign minister, who, in the government, who are key negotiators on Darfur. And I think we'd all hoped that this new government of national unity would take a much more balanced approach to Darfur. And I think, in fact, there are splits within the government and some people being more willing to accommodate than others. And, of course, the irony is, in the south, there is indeed a UN peacekeeping force helping keep the peace there without any apparent sort of political difficulty or reaction to it, which is what makes so ironic and ultimately unjustifiable the argument that you couldn't have the UN in Darfur. But I think there is one key point to be understood, which is Darfur came so quickly on the heels of the ending of the rebellion in the south that the promised new aid and lifting of sanctions that was to come to the south after that war ended didn't come because suddenly Sudan was once more at odds with the world over Darfur. So the Sudanese government in Khartoum feels it was betrayed by the international community and the promises given to it to make peace in the south were not kept. And that has undoubtedly hardened its attitude towards the West.
Don't you think, though, The fact that the western part of Sudan is not a Christian area plays a significant role, because you know the south was Christian and it was supported by the mainstream Christian churches in the U.S. and we know the Lost Boys program was brought to bring the southern Sudanese refugees from the south into the U.S. Do you think the fact that the west is a Muslim and a black area is one of the reasons why this Darfur conflict doesn't bring anything into the picture of the West?
Well, look, I mean, the South conflict went on for close to 20 years, and the growing support for the rebels in the South from Christians in the U.S. grew over that time. It wasn't born instantly. You're seeing similarly not, you know, a tremendous a protest movement building in the U.S. today against what is happening in Darfur. I myself have spoken at a number of meetings of grassroots civil society organizations in the states who've taken up the cause of Darfur in a very, very big way. But, you know, I think it is the case that it is a Muslim-on-Muslim attacks in the West, and, you know, that should at the very least mean that Muslim countries should share the outrage of Americans against what is happening in Darfur and should help broaden this coalition of opposition beyond the U.S. and other Western countries to being a much bigger, more international condemnation.
If indeed that can be done in time. Meshach, thanks very much for the call. Finally, one email question. This is from Nancy in Detroit. For 3 years, the United States, the United Nations, any number of other entities have called the Darfur situation urgent. How long can one say something is urgent before the word loses all meaning?
I think it's a very, I mean, I share the sentiment of that email entirely. I can't tell you that even as a veteran of Lebanon and everything else that's been going on in the world in recent months and years, you know, Darfur is the one which keeps me awake most at night because I feel so frustrated at the inability of the international community to back up its words with real deeds in terms of, you know, getting a new security in place for the victims there. And, you know, we can't have, I mean, it's a time now of decision. The Security Council and the international community has to push Sudan to accept, and if Sudan won't accept, then we have to find other ways of achieving this mission. We cannot turn our backs on the people of Darfur and just utter these platitudes and not back them up.
Mark Malik Brown, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mark Malik Brown, Deputy Secretary General to the United Nations. He joined us today by phone from his office at the UN in New York City. Joining us now is Jendai Fraser, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs. She's just returned from Sudan, as you heard, after meeting with President Omar al-Bashir. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
You were in Sudan talking with the president about a possible UN force. Did he agree to it? Do you think he still will agree to it?
President Bashir has maintained his position so far that there is no need for the UN peacekeeping force to come to Darfur. He his government, he didn't himself, but his government maintained that they could work with the African Union, beef up its capability, and the government of Sudan together would be sufficient to secure peace there and to implement the Darfur peace agreement. Of course, the United States does not agree with that position.
And he's also told those AU troops to leave unless they get funding directly from the Sudanese government and the Arab League.
That's the report, but I've been in touch with the senior leadership of the African Union, as well as the heads of state of many of the troop-contributing countries and their foreign ministries, and they have not received any formal notification from the government of Sudan asking them to leave. The threat hangs over their head, certainly, but in fact, that report is not confirmed, and the parties affected have not have said that they haven't received any such notification from the government.
You have expressed concern about the buildup of Sudanese forces. Others have reported that combat is, in fact, already underway in some parts of Darfur. And again, the Washington Post's report this morning that analysts, AU mission members and observers believe that the Sudanese government is trying to get this rebellion crushed and out of the way before the deployment of UN troops. Is that fair assessment, do you think?
I think that's absolutely a fair assessment. We've been, President Bashir himself wrote a letter to Kofi Annan saying that they thought that the answer to dealing with the insecurity in Darfur was to crush the National Resistance Front, the non-signatories who previously had been supported by the government of Chad and the government of Eritrea. And they wrote that they would deploy 10,500 troops to Darfur to take care of this problem and to provide the forces that would implement the DPA. Now, clearly that's a violation both of the Darfur Peace Agreement as well as the N'Djamena Ceasefire Agreement, which they have signed in the past, and they signed that agreement with some members who are part of the National Resistance Front. And so we've been pushing and urging them as well as others that there is no military solution to the crisis in Darfur.
We're speaking with Jendai Fraser, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And so what if the Sudanese government goes ahead and acts on the basis of that letter?
Well, then I think, as Mark Malik Brown has said, we as an international community need to keep up the pressure. We need to isolate the government of Sudan, and we need to implement UN Security Council Resolution 1706, which includes protecting of civilian lives. We have been pushing in this direction for some time now. We have numerous UN Security Council resolutions deploring the violence that's taken place and has taken place in Darfur. We also have repeated AU Peace and Security Council communiques calling for a transition of their forces to UN. And so now that we have the Security Council resolution, we need to push for its enforcement, and that is hopefully seeking a diplomatic resolution, getting the government of Sudan to accept the world community's views. And any other options would actually be suboptimal. But we're going to keep pressing on the diplomatic front to isolate the government, bring the pressure to bear, so that they can take a reasonable course to ending this crisis.
Before or after the government's offensive is finished?
Well, we've been working before the government offensive started. We are going to continue as it's occurring and try to get it to stop immediately. We certainly will continue to put, as I said, the pressure on them, try to get them isolated, work with other governments to bring pressure to bear. But we are working directly with the government. We're working directly with other governments.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. played a critical role in achieving the agreement in southern Sudan. Is there anything, given that experience, that you think will avert this offensive before it goes on?
The problem that we have with the government of Sudan is it seems unable to learn lessons from the past or unwilling to learn lessons from the past. What we found in Sudan with the North-South Agreement was that there was no way that the government could wipe out the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement, and the government came to that recognition. The same is true in Darfur. They cannot wipe out the non-signatories. We've got to reach out to the non-signatories, work with them, to bring them on board with the Darfur peace agreement, but there is no military solution. The government seems to continue to think, and I say the government, I really mean elements of the government, because the government of Sudan, the government of national unity, isn't entirely agreed on this course of action. But there are members of that government, including apparently the president, who believe that there's the military solution is a possibility. But that's clearly a lesson that they should have learned from the South. They should have learned from the first launching of their counterinsurgency effort, which led to the displacement of over 2 million people and hundreds of thousands of deaths. And there's no way that a military solution is possible.
Secretary Fraser, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jendai Fraser, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. We'll be back after the break to discuss a new biography of I.F. Stone, All Governments Lie. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.